Hi, this is Nivet with Statement Guru, the internet's preferred destination for admissions essay expertise. Today I'm with Jessica Yeager of ImpressTheIvies.com. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
How are you today?
I'm good.
Thanks for being on the podcast.
Sure.
Can you briefly tell us what ImpressTheIvies.com is all about?
Sure. ImpressTheIvies is my thoughts about how you can impress the Ivies, of course. So I went to Harvard for undergrad and MIT for grad school, and I didn't really come from a background where there was a lot of people from my high school or my family going to Ivy Leagues. I kind of had to figure out how to do it myself. And I know there are many, many students out there that, you know, really want to go to these schools, but aren't being given very good information on how to make their applications better, craft their applications better to get into these schools, or how to pick the right courses or extracurricular activities to give yourself that leg up to get into schools like Harvard and Yale.
So we'll touch upon all of that in this episode, but let's begin the discussion by kind of talking about your background a bit more and
sure.
The strategies you personally use to get into not only Harvard but and MIT, but you got into some very top places when you were applying, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, I got it. Let's talk.
I can give you the spiel.
Yeah.
So I got into Harvard, Yale, Cornell, Columbia, MIT, Stanford, WashU, and St. Louis. And I did not get into Princeton. Princeton was the one I didn't get into.
So you're telling me that WashU was your safety school?
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
Actually...
You're pissing off a lot of people right now.
I also got into my safety school, which... Totally. The only reason I applied was because I got a free application was University of Rochester, which I knew nothing about.
Okay.
So I guess that was technically my CFT school.
You know, I was so unfamiliar with the college admissions process. I think part of it was, my parents came from another country that mm-hmm. I actually thought for a while that to apply to a school, they had to send you a brochure. I was really not hip to the whole admissions thing. I really could have benefited from somebody like you back then.
Right? I mean, that I feel the same way. I was just kind of doing what I thought would maybe help me, but it was very, I had no idea really what I was doing.
So let's talk about that. So a lot sure. of people have that impression that that in order to get considered by some of these top universities is you need to go to some elite boarding school in Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that was not the high school you were going to. So,
no. And I will say that definitely helps. I'm not going to lie. Yeah. There's a lot of kids from those schools. But, you know, I went to a small all-girls Catholic school in Kansas City, Missouri. I think maybe there had been someone who went to Harvard from my school in the decade before I went there. And that was probably it. And I kind of doubt there'd ever been anyone who went to MIT, honestly.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the norm for sure. Now it was a very good school. I'm not, it was a college prep school. But it was not the norm to even apply to those types of schools.
And my school was similar in that respect. Like, I went to a school in basically suburban LA,
mm-hmm.
very, very suburban, let's say rural LA. And like the top sort of places people were going were places like UCLA and Berkeley, which are great schools,
mm-hmm.
but the scope of where people's ambition lied was really just in the state of California.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of going to some remote, cold region of the country, regardless of how prestigious it was really mm-hmm. just not in the people's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Partly because there wasn't the culture of it. Like, you don't see people from previous years going to these places.
Yes.
And part of it is just the ambition really wasn't there. And it was, you know, if you went to your commissions counselor, they were talking about your UC essays or what to put together for your UC thing, because that's what they know. And that was, that was ambitious, to be honest, because a lot of people would go to community college, or they would go to even a, like a Cal State, which is a lot easier to get into.
And that's the thing too. Like, we had one admissions counselor for over 100 girls, and just in senior year. So that admissions counselor is also supposed to be advising juniors and sophomores, right? So it was also, you know, there's just not, if you're one of 100 or one of 200, you're just not going to get, you know, the same focus that you are giving things yourself, or you would get if you had someone who was just looking out for you.
So how did you decide that you wanted to take on this task of getting into these top places, and what did you start to do to prepare?
So it's funny, because I never grew up thinking, oh, I want to go to Harvard. And I, and maybe this is, you know, a little bit of a girl thing, or a feel of failure, fear of failure thing. But I remember when I was in grade school, so I went to a small Catholic grade school. There was about 50 kids in my class, and I was this, you know, quote unquote, smartest person in my class. Right. And I remember taking the, like going into high school, and I remember telling myself, now you probably won't be the smartest person in your high school. You know, like, it's a different playing field. Right. But so I already kind of, I didn't set my expectations very high. I wasn't, I was never like, oh, I'm definitely going to Harvard. You know, I never, I guess, wanted to fail at something that I said I was going to do. Right. And so I went to high school, and I just, I've always tried my best. I've, that's just my personality, is to always try my best. My parents never had to, you know, nag on me about doing my homework or anything like that. I just, doing my best was my personal self-image. My, that's where I got my pride. And so I just did my best, and I got really good grades. I always did really well on standardized testing. But the fact of the matter is, you know, if Harvard let in all of the 1600s, you know, with the old SAT scoring and all of the 4.0s, they still would have to reject some of those kids, right? So just doing that, just getting good grades and just getting good test scores doesn't get you in. And it was, I didn't do the things that I did to get into Harvard or to get into MIT. I just did them because I wanted to do something different. I saw a need for something. Like, I started a club with my friend at school that was all about like environment, so recycling and different things like that, and social justice. So we did like a voter registration drive and different things like that. Like, I saw a need, and I wanted to create something to fill that need. We also developed a foster parent resource fair as our volunteer work that we did our junior and senior year. So it wasn't, oh, I, you know, volunteered at a soup kitchen once a week. It was something different. It was something not a lot of people were doing. It was something that was a risk to do. And I did those things, not, like I said, not to get into Harvard or MIT, just because I wanted to do them. That was my self-image. So it wasn't planned, but looking back on it, it's very obvious to me that these things that I did really set me apart from most people, especially one thing you have to keep in mind is that when applications are being judged, they're looking at you in your context, right? So I'm a girl from the Midwest. What I do is going to be different than what a guy from the West Coast does, or, you know, even a girl from the East Coast does. So you want to make sure that what you're doing is setting you apart from those other people.
Right. And that's something that I feel like what was kind of initially a liability, which is nobody's gone to these places from your school, becomes a strength because nobody goes to these places from your school. And so you can be highly original in the way you're perceived by these institutions. Okay, so you get into these schools, and why did you decide to go to Harvard, or is it too obvious to answer that question?
It was sort of, so I knew I wanted to go to a big city. So I was kind of one, MIT honestly was kind of intimidating to me. And I also wasn't positive that I wanted to do engineering. And I thought, just in case, I'm pretty sure I want to do environmental engineering, but just in case I don't, if I go to MIT, I'm kind of stuck with that, right? Whereas if I go to Harvard, I can change my mind and do, any other thing that, and they are extremely renowned for anything, right? And so I was debating between Harvard and Columbia in New York. But when it really came down to it, I was like, how can I not go to Harvard? I got into Harvard. How can I not go to Harvard? So that's sort of how I decided. They also gave me the best financial aid package, so
Did you
that
visit
helped.
all the schools that you
I
got
didn't
into?
visit any of them,
Oh,
actually.
really?
The only school that I had visited, which I definitely don't recommend, it's definitely much better even for your chances of getting in to visit these schools. But the only school I visited before applying was WashU in St. Louis, which I didn't even visit for a college visit. I actually did a summer program there. And so that's how I visited there. I didn't visit Harvard until the summer before freshman year of college.
So I hoped you
And
liked it when you went there.
yeah, I did. But that's the thing too. Like, I know my personality and I don't like my surroundings don't have that big of an effect on me. Like, if you're one of those people who, if you're in a situation and your external, whatever's happening externally has a huge effect on you, then yes, you definitely need to visit all of the schools you might be going to. But I knew, I can find a place here. Even if, I don't like XYZ, I'll find ABC that I do like.
And you still live in Cambridge, right?
And I still live in Cambridge, yeah.
So it worked out in terms
It worked out,
of
yeah.
there's something about the area that has appealed to you, obviously.
I gotta say though, I went to the Bay Area recently for work, and I was like, man, it's a good thing I didn't visit before I went to school because I really think I would have had a hard time saying no to Stanford after visiting the Bay Area.
And Stanford has kind of become almost like the rival to, in some sense, to Harvard in some ways because of they had the lowest admissions rate in the country this year.
Yeah, everybody wants the Cali lifestyle.
Yeah, and I think also the tech culture is so prominent these days, and Stanford, I mean MIT as well, but Stanford has the benefit of geography. And it's so synonymous with the Silicon Valley just boom, and which Harvard, to be honest, is a little like part. I mean, I think a lot of it is its proximity to MIT, so it hasn't really emphasized engineering throughout its history. I mean, I think it's changing, but it's still, because I work with a lot of applicants coming from India and very heavy engineering type backgrounds. And I mean, I think they respect Harvard as a name and the history, but if you were to ask a lot of them, they would much rather go to a place like Berkeley, Stanford, Carnegie Mellon,
Well,
MIT.
I'll tell you, I mean, I still have people who are like, Harvard has engineering. So, yeah, I totally, that's not unusual. In fact, the School of Applied Sciences and Engineering started, so it used to be just a department when I started there in 2004. So I think the school was created right, maybe 2007 or 2008, right when I was graduating.
Okay, and is that a graduate department or undergrad and graduate department?
Undergrad and grad. So it's
So it's spun
it
off from what?
So it was just like a department of the college, and now it's technically the school. So it's technically a separate school. Now, I don't know how that actually plays out. I think they can maybe attract a little better faculty or something like that, but it sort of elevated the emphasis on their engineering and applied sciences.
What did you major in undergrad?
Environmental engineering.
Okay, so it's an SB, it's not an AB?
It's an SB, yes, the only one Harvard offers, Harvard College.
Okay.
And I had a lot more requirements than my than my counterparts, my friends doing psych majors and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, you see the AB a lot in terms of just like people's credentials, but the SB is actually a bit rare.
Yes,
and now I know why, it's the extra requirements.
Yeah, and you know, if you so. I knew that I wanted to be a practicing engineer, and if you want to be a practicing engineer and take your tests and become a licensed engineer, which is what I am, you have to take the SB. But if you know you want to actually go to med school, which a lot of the kids who are getting ABs were doing, or you want to, you know, go on to graduate school, get your PhD, whatever, you know you're not going to be a practicing engineer, the AB is great because you don't have as many requirements, but you're still, you know, majoring in engineering.
Got it. So let's kind of talk about, I think, Harvard, but also the Ivy League in general, in terms of, okay, there's a couple things. One is, it seems like Harvard, I know, but probably in general, are helping them, you know, with their tuition, in a lot of cases paying most, if not all, of their tuition.
Yes.
Let's talk about that, as well as how the Ivy League is perceived and what your experiences have been with that. And, you know, was it worth it?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's first talk about financial aid. Definitely, if you are, you know, lower on the socioeconomic scale, Harvard is extreme, and the other Ivy Leagues and similar, MIT, Stanford, are extremely, extremely generous. They keep raising the minimum household income where you have no parental contribution. So I don't remember exactly what it is, but they have a great calculator on their website.
It's around 60,000.
And you pay nothing, right? I always tell people when they're like, oh, you went to Harvard, you know, which the assumption is, oh, you're some like rich kid from Massachusetts, right? And I always tell them, and this is the truth, I went to Harvard for less than my sister went to University of Kansas. And there is a big perception, especially among lower income people or lower income schools, that, oh, well, I might as well not apply to Harvard because there's no way I can pay for it. Mm-hmm. And Harvard, they don't give merit scholarships. The only financial aid they do is need-based, and they meet 100% of your demonstrated need. And this is for at least U.S. citizens. For international kids, it's not guaranteed, I believe, that they'll meet 100% of your financial need, but many, many international kids get 100% of their need met. And not only that, but included in that is your, like, what they calculate as the cost to attend Harvard includes travel back home. It includes, you know, if you're from a warm climate, if you're from Hawaii, it includes buying winter clothes. Like, it's very, very comprehensive, which is unusual, especially even for, you know, private elite, you know, a tier below Harvard. It's very unusual to have that kind of extensive financial aid. And it keeps getting better every year.
And this is a relatively new initiative in terms of the Ivy League, I feel, right?
Yeah, I would say it's maybe 10 years old, 15 years old. I know I have friends who graduated from MIT and like late 90s that have, you know, had crushing student debt because they didn't have this financial aid initiative in place. So I want to say it's less than 20 years old by a lot. So maybe less than 15 years old. And not only that, but they've also targeted having admissions officers go to these lower income schools or neighborhoods to have discussions about Ivy League schools to expose these students who might not necessarily think Harvard is a possibility for them.
And where do you think that comes from? Do you think it's to stay current, to stay relevant, to not
absolutely
challenge perceptions?
I think it's all of those things. I think it's also, schools like Harvard, they place a high value on diversity of their students. And that includes socioeconomic diversity. And I think the reason for that, not only does obviously that give you, a warm, fuzzy feeling and give the public warm, fuzzy feeling, but the more people you have with different backgrounds and different ideas, the more innovation you're going to have, the more in-depth discussions you're going to have. If you have a bunch of people who, have basically the same background, have the same ideas on things, that's not going to be challenging. They're not going to be challenged. Their perception of the world isn't going to be challenged, and you're not going to get those creative solutions to the world's problems.
Were you surprised by how diverse or dynamic the place was?
I don't know that I had necessarily preconceived notions of what Harvard was going to be like, because I, it wasn't something that I was really very exposed to. Mm-hmm. But it definitely is. And it's definitely one of those places where, just like anywhere else, there's going to be, people who you don't like or you don't get along with, but there's going to be people who you love and who you learn crazy things from and who do crazy things and push you to really do your best and do more than you thought you could.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that it was worth it? I mean, I think that's, it sounds like you do, but
definitely.
In terms of, how would you sell the Ivy League or Harvard to somebody who's maybe reluctant to leave wherever they're from and they were looking towards community college or their local state mm-hmm. school?
Yeah, so...
And they have a negative impression, let's say, of, on there's a bit of a backlash, and I've read these articles, don't send your kid to the Ivy League.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've noticed that there's, and even in the media, there's kind of like this narrative of politicians who went to these type of schools being out of touch ruining the country. A lot of the people that run these banks and, there's that crisis, a lot of them probably had those kind of pedigrees. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to this sort of rhetoric that's a little there's a little disdain for these type of institutions?
Yeah, absolutely. So, are there rich boys clubs and, I'm sure people have heard of finals clubs, especially after The Social Network and these, exclusive things and these uber rich people who are flying on their dad's private jet. Yes, there's those people. I'm not going to lie to you. There are those people. But there's also people who don't have all those things who are so very different than the people you would encounter at your state school, right? So at my state school, University of Missouri, a lot of people would have come from similar backgrounds as me, right? And there's also less desire to really challenge your way of thinking or the expectations you have of yourself. Whereas at Harvard, I mean, very few people had the same background as me at Harvard. There is maybe 5 kids in my class from Kansas City or something like that. And I didn't really know any of them. And putting yourself in a situation where you don't know anybody, you didn't come to that school with kids from your high school or kids from your town, I mean, it really puts you out of your comfort zone, right? And that's where a lot of kids are. And you can find those kids that really have the same sort of values as you. You don't have to hang out with those people who, you know, have a private jet or whatever. If you want to, go for it. But that perception that everybody is like that is just wrong. And you can find these people that will do great things. Like one of my best friends from undergrad is a stand-up comic now, and he is doing amazing things. He was on Conan this like a couple of months ago. And that's something where, you know, that's not the kind of person that I would have encountered necessarily at a state school, right? Like, that's kind of not that those people don't exist. It's just a lot rarer. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, one of my roommates from Harvard won a silver medal in the Beijing Olympics. Like, that's someone like me. That's not someone I would encounter in mm-hmm. a normal place. And, you know, it really, you are just in an environment where people challenge each other. And, you know, most of my friends from Harvard are in med school, in law school, got graduate degrees, went to Wharton, got an MBA, are, you know, VPs at their company, are, you know, appearing on Conan O'Brien. So it just makes you challenge yourself more when you're around people who challenge themselves and expect a lot from themselves. It makes you expect more from yourself.
I think you're intimidating some people, but I think some people were inspired. So.
I mean, I would definitely say that I was intimidated at first too. So that's not, you got to embrace that, right? You got to embrace that and say, you can do it. You can rise to this level. Because if you're the big fish in the small pond, that feels great, right? But you're not being challenged.
Yeah. Okay, so let's shift this discussion back in time to not so much about your experiences, but say if there's somebody who is a senior in high school, or they're earlier in their high school years, like they're a sophomore, they're a freshman, what strategies, what can they be doing?
Yep.
You know, like, let's assume they're not going to some top private school that has that, those resources, and that has the admissions counselors that can really guide them. So, you know, what would your advice be, and how do they get started thinking in terms of, I want to go to these places and I want to make that happen?
Yeah. So first I'll give advice for the non-seniors, because once you're a senior, you're really going to focus on your application. And there's only so much you can do for different things. But if you're not a senior, so first and foremost, you need to hit that academic minimum. So you want to be in the top 5% of your class. If you can be valedictorian of your class, even better. But that's sort of what you need to set your sights on. And you should be taking the hardest classes available at your school. So some people are like, oh, my school doesn't have any AP classes. Like, I just have no shot for, you know, getting into these schools. It doesn't matter. You're being judged on what your school has to offer. So take the hardest classes your school has to offer and get A's in them. That's really what you should be setting your sights on. Now, if that's going to, and obviously, that can be very difficult for some people. And if it's difficult for you, especially if you are this like amazing, amazing in English and you get A pluses in English, but your math, you struggle in math, you should be talking to your teacher, your math teacher, about what you can do. You should be seeking out outside help. You should be seeking out help from your parents and really focusing on getting those grades really, really high. And once you get those grades high, once you are in, you know, top 5%, don't worry about it. So I know there's a lot of people who, same with your SATs. So let's say, like, really you want to get minimum 700 on all of the subjects. But I don't want you to then spend, oh, I want to get, you know, 750 in math. So I'm going to spend 80 hours studying to change my 700 to a 750. That's not worth it. Once you get those minimum, that minimum academic and testing levels, it's not, you're not going to get very much reward for that added time. So focus on other things. And those other things to focus on would be your extracurricular activities. So, and by extracurricular activities, I mean clubs, sports, musical instruments, work, summer activities, that kind of thing.
One thing we've talked about, excuse me, one thing we've talked about is this idea of branding yourself with a specific identity, basically. Like you talked about being in a math and science person with a social justice orientation.
Yes.
And it's never too early to start thinking in those terms, I think.
Not at all. Not at all. You have to. You have to. That's the thing. These schools, we've all heard of the, you know, everybody wants a well-rounded student. Not true. These schools don't want well-rounded students. They want a well-rounded student body. Okay. So you want them to take, look at your application and be like, this is the math and science person that, you know, she won all of these awards in math and science, all of her APs and test scores and school record reflects this math and science background. She started a blog about women in math and science. She volunteers. She created this, you know, summer program for girls to learn engineering. Like everything should go back to that base, that whatever is your thing, your theme, your base, everything should reflect back on that, because that's, you want them to remember you, and that's how they remember you. They're not going to remember you if, oh, she did like 10 unrelated clubs and like only did them, you know, was just a member of them for a year and then, you know, half-heartedly did this other activity, and that's not very memorable.
You can almost think of it, you can almost think of it like a hook.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that's what you should be focusing on. So you can figure out, okay, what is my base? What do I care about? What could I do all of these different things about? Like what interests me? What am I good at? And then build from there. You can create, start a club that reflects back on that. So maybe you are a tech person and there's no coding club at your school. Start a coding club. And the other thing I'm going to focus on with this is leadership. So there's a few different ways to convey leadership. One of them is to, you know, join a club your freshman year that you could see being in all 4 years and eventually being president of that club. So either your junior or senior year being president of that club. And just kind of as your minimum requirement, I would recommend doing that with two clubs. And now if you didn't do that freshman year and you're a sophomore, do it sophomore year. And the easiest way to be president of a club is to start your own club. So that's kind of a shortcut. If you're like, I'm a junior, I don't, you know, I'm not sure how to do this, start your own club. That's one of my tricks to
hack. That's a high school hack.
Yeah, high school hack. Exactly. Exactly. But you know, part of that, all of these schools are also looking for leaders. They want students who are going to change the world. Honestly, that's what Harvard wants. Harvard wants students who are going to change the world. So you need to be looking at what you're doing and thinking, is this something that could have, you know, long-term effects? Is this teaching me the skills I need to one day change the world? And that seems like really intimidating also, but it's, you know, when I was doing these things, I wasn't thinking that. I was just thinking, you know, this is something I want to do. I see a need and I want to do this. And if that's your thought process, that's totally fine.
But I feel like it's getting more and more competitive. So
yes,
maybe
yes.
A generation ago, these thoughts would never even come into people's heads.
Exactly.
And now it's essential almost to really get an early start for
It is. It absolutely is.
Being a competitive candidate. And it's just, it's unreal how the demand has grown for these places.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And
I
you know,
will say,
these campuses aren't getting any bigger. These classroom sizes aren't getting any bigger, but the applicant pool is. So.
Yes. And I will say some of that is that they are also like more unqualified applicants are applying. So don't be like, oh my God, like even more intimidated because that percentage has gone down. You also have a higher percentage of unqualified applicants that, you know, just applied for the sake of applying.
Why are they doing that?
You know, I think it's, there's more knowledge about Harvard. So they are marketing applying to Harvard more. So there's just more people out there that think about applying to it. It's also a lot easier now with Common App.
You know, it's funny. So it's unique to Harvard is like I have a pretty decent sized Facebook presence in terms of my Facebook group and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And just from interacting with all these random people across the world, there are these people that have clearly never been in the United States and don't speak English that will just put Harvard University as their school on Facebook.
Yeah.
And so there's probably millions of people that have just arbitrarily, based on it being so famous, have just decided to put that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, you know, like I said, with the Common App, it's so much easier. You don't have to, you know, do that much extra to apply.
Yeah.
So if that gives, you know, it's still very hard. I'm not going to lie. It's still very hard to get into these schools. And even if you do everything right, you know, if you're the X person and they already have an X person.
They'll make you do a fight to the death combat situation. Yeah.
So, you know, you could have everything right. And there is an amount of, you know, subjectivity. So it's not like if you do everything right, you're guaranteed a spot at Harvard. Obviously, that's not true. But you can definitely give yourself.
It reminds me a little of when you talk about your identifying thing or having a hook. It kind of reminds me of the X-Men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So think of Harvard or these Ivy League schools as these kind of academies where they are trying to nurture very special people with special abilities. Yeah. And if you don't feel like you have that, I think it lurks with everybody somewhere, and it's a matter of finding it and honing it and embracing it and showing the world that you've taken this seriously.
And that's the key too, because there's a lot of students who have this, but either they don't realize they have it or they're just really bad at telling people they have it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the other thing.
You know, for me, I actually felt like I took initiative in my own way in terms of I was interested in screenwriting and filmmaking. Mm-hmm. And I had written so much in high school in terms of like screenplays and all this stuff. But I didn't think there was a natural outlet to for that to really translate on my application.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt, I think mine was a situation of I didn't channel it in ways where it made that much of an impression on the schools.
Yes. So I think that's a great example. So you have a lot of people just to make it a little more general. Let's say you love writing and you write for your school newspaper and you write novels just for fun, right? Well, there's a lot of kids who do that. But what you could do to set yourself apart is send some of those articles or different articles to your city newspaper, right? Get published as like this, you know, student opinion piece or whatever in your city newspaper. Well, that's unusual. Or if you've written these novels, self-publish them on Amazon. It's not that hard, you know, and now you're a published writer. And it's those kind of things where, you know, the standard take on it would just be, oh, I'm just like, I like really like writing for fun. I've written these three novels. Well, what have you done with those novels? Oh, they're just for fun. You know, I've done nothing. Whereas the other person who is going to really impress the Ivies, they will say, oh, well, I published it on Amazon. I had, you know, however many, I don't know how you judge Amazon, downloads or whatever.
They have rankings. Yeah, they have rankings. And,
yeah, it was ranked X, yeah, or it had 1,000 downloads or whatever. Or, you know, I had 5 articles published in my city's newspaper. You know, it's these kind of things where it doesn't take that much extra work to take it to that next level, but so few people do that you will stand out, yeah, just by taking it to that next level.
And the resources are there, like something like self-publishing on Amazon. It didn't really exist when I was applying.
Exactly, exactly.
So people really have no excuse for not taking these steps that are not even that hard. It's just, it's nobody's going to hold your hand through the process. You have to, yeah, you have to work harder and you have to put forth the effort. And it requires going above the minimum.
Exactly.
As does writing the novel in the first place. But this is, you know, if you've gone that far, you might as well spend that extra 5 hours figuring that part out.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's get into more specifics. You talked about extracurriculars. So let's talk about test taking, which is a common theme in your blog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... for test taking, there's tons of tests that students take during their high school years. You have your kind of pre-ACT test, which is the planned test, right? And that doesn't really count for anything except prepping you for the ACT. And you have PSAT, which PSAT your junior year, you know, I definitely recommend really prepping for that and trying to get be a National Merit Scholar, because that's something that is pretty, you know, recognized as these are the kids who did the best on the PSATs. Like that's a very good nationally recognized achievement to have. Hmm. And then you have the SATs and then the SAT subject tests, which Harvard actually doesn't require anymore. But my tip, an easy win on the SAT subject test, if you're taking an AP test, so let's say you're taking AP American History, take the American History subject test in SATs at the same time, so the end of the school year, because you'll have done all of the studying and prep work for your AP test, and all you'll have to do is maybe take a couple SAT subject practice tests to get the format down. You'll mm-hmm. have all the subject matter already down from your AP class. So that's my another hack for test taking. So with respect to standardized testing, standardized tests can be learned. You can get better at them. That's the thing. I think some people are just like, oh, I'm a bad test taker, or, you know, they don't think that you can study for these tests. That's absolutely not true. Studying for these tests improves your score dramatically. Just taking practice tests improves your score dramatically, because it's not something that most people are used to. It's not a kind of format that most people encounter in their normal activities. So that's one thing. Like, you definitely need to practice and study for these tests.
Okay.
Now, I have tutored in these tests in the ACT and SAT and some other standardized tests, and I definitely think that tutoring can help. I think there are a lot of courses that can help. I think some courses are definitely better than others, and there's also great prep books out there if you're someone who can self-motivate and practice for these tests. That's a great way to go as well, but definitely the best way to improve your score is to study and practice, is to take practice tests. That's really the secret sauce to getting good test scores.
Yeah. Do you have a listing of preferred resources or anything like that? Or is there any way, any of your recommendations we could find out about?
So I don't have a, like a list of test prep, because test prep books change, you know, every year, all the time. But one program that I think is really good is, the Green, G-R-E-E-N, ACT and SAT prep. It's this Anthony Green. He's like the $1,000 an hour, SAT tutor to the 1%. Mm-hmm. He has a program online, a course online for both the SAT and ACT that I think is really, really good. It's backed up by the score, by very large changes in scores that his students get. That's one thing where a lot of these courses and books and things will say, oh, if you didn't improve, you can get your money back. But an improvement of, you know, 10 points or 50 points is nothing. Like, you'll get that just by taking the test again, just because you'll be more familiar with the test. It doesn't mean that that course or that book really made that change. And I think his program is really, really good. It's really intense. You do a lot of work. It's a lot of work. But, you know, his students get hundreds of points improvements on the SAT, obviously, not on the ACT. Wow. But yeah, so it's, that is the one that I would recommend.
Okay.
If you're looking for a course.
Great. So it's Green, SAT, yeah. ACT.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
And you can look up Anthony Green or, you know, anything like that.
Okay. So let's not focus too much on essays, but simply because I feel like a lot of people who are familiar with me have probably sick of me talking about essays.
Well, I have a good essay story, though.
Okay.
I'll tell you my personal essay story.
Sure.
So I wrote one essay, basically, for all of my applications. Guess which application did not get that one essay?
What do you mean did not get? Oh, the Princeton one.
Yes. So exactly. So the Princeton application was four short answers, and I couldn't use my essay that I had used for all of my other applications. And that's the one school that I didn't get into. Now, was the essay the only factor? Probably not. But that's one thing that really, you know, I learned something from that, you know, I had this essay that I had really, really crafted to tell my story. It was about being a girl who was good at math, basically. And, you know, I had different questions that I tweaked it for. So the essay I wrote it for was for MIT's application. And then Harvard and Yale, I think, had the Common App, so it was pretty general what your essay could be about. But Stanford had, oh, you had to write an essay about a picture. And so I think some people would think, oh, well, I can't use this essay that I wrote to answer this other question. But all I did was find a picture of myself, you know, as a kid. It was actually me doing like a Supergirl, Superwoman pose. And I just was like, added a couple of sentences to the beginning saying, you know, whatever, this was me, you know, being proud of myself or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that is something that's really valuable. It's intimidating to think, oh my God, I have to write 10 amazing essays for all these different schools because they all are asking different questions. But if you can look at them and think, well, is there one question they're all asking that's pretty similar? And maybe I can tweak my essay a little bit to be, you know, a little more fine-tuned to what this particular school is looking at, then I don't have to write 10 essays. I have to write one really, really good essay that I can tweak.
That's similar to a strategy I recommend where I'll tell the applicant, I'll say, okay, what is your most preferred school or what has the earliest deadline? And I'll say, as much as possible, obviously, there's a limit to this, and you might have to just write a new essay, but I'll say, all right, let's concentrate on that, and let's make that the best it could possibly be, and then we'll see how we can adapt that to the other prompts or the other schools or the other even word limits, and I find that putting that effort into one thing and making that as good as possible serves them better than trying to make five different Absolutely. Five different essays to fulfill five different requirements. Absolutely. Because there's only so much, there's only going to be so much variation anyway.
Exactly. Exactly.
Great. So that's great advice about the essay. Now, can we talk about something that's a little more specific to top colleges, which is the interview?
Yes. Yeah. So I think the interview can definitely be very intimidating for students. I know I had a student that I was coaching on interviewing, and he was definitely very nervous about it. And I think kids especially, so your senior year, you only have so much control over a lot of things in your application, right? You can't really change your GPA. You can't really change, you know, all your extracurriculars from the past 4 years, but you have complete control over your essay and your interview. So those become very big in your mind and can be very stressful. You know, you're trying to impress this person. And the biggest help with interviews, just like with test taking, is practice. You know, you want to ask your parents, your friends, anybody that will do it, really, to help you practice, to interview with you, to see if there's something you're doing. Maybe you don't notice, but you have this nervous tick and it makes you look really shifty. So it's great to be practicing.
Twirling your mustache.
Yeah. It's great to practice with someone else to really get those out of your system so that you can be calm. And it also just, it helps with you feeling comfortable in your essay. In your interview, if you've practiced, if you've gone over some things, these are the topics that I kind of want to bring up. And I, you know, you have some answers to very common questions. You're just going to be so much more relaxed, and that's going to be a better experience for you, and you're going to come off better. So that's really interviews, practice, and record what you're doing too. That's the other thing. If you don't have someone who can work with you, or even if you do, record it, because it's a lot easier to see these things that, you know, oh, like, I really didn't have a good answer for that question, or, oh, I like, and like messing with my hair constantly. I gotta remember to like put my hair up or something like that. So that's the biggest thing with interviews, is just practice them. It's just like job interviews. Practice
mm-hmm.
them.
Mm-hmm. Great. Did you have any other general tips that you can think of about the process that come to mind?
What I like to do is think about some things that maybe you didn't really get to talk a lot about in your application, or you didn't get to convey in your application, especially if it's something that you can bring to campus. So, like, let's say you started a nonprofit that focuses on collecting clothes for a women's shelter. And it's on your resume, but you didn't really go in depth on that in your application because there just wasn't really a chance. And that's something that you think sets you apart and you really love and is really valuable. My recommendation is think of a way to tie that into your interview, bring it up. You know, there's going to be something where they'll be like, oh, do you have a question for me? And a great question would be, so I run this nonprofit, and I was wondering if there would be a way to, you know, either if there are similar nonprofits on campus, or if there would be a way to partner with someone on campus. Like, is that something that's encouraged? What would be the way you would do that? So you're doing several things. One, you have an intelligent, unique question to ask them.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you are showing this initiative. So you're getting to talk about this initiative you took to create this nonprofit. And three, you're demonstrating the value you will bring to campus, to student life. All of those things are exactly what schools are looking for.
And I think bringing out these less focused on parts of your profile here makes a lot of sense, because
mm-hmm.
there is very limited space in the application itself.
Yes, Exactly. And I would say this is particularly important if you're doing an on-campus interview with admissions people. Like, it's a little, if you're doing this with, if you're doing an interview with an alum, they might not, you know, really be able to speak to it too much, but especially if you're doing an on-campus interview with admissions officers, you should bring these things up.
Right.
And again, the key is to practice. The key is to develop a way to weave that into your conversation, not be like, oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about this thing too.
Great. Well, I'm scared to go above an hour here, so maybe we should wrap up.
Sure.
So I think it was a great conversation. There's a lot of insights. I was actually thinking of maybe having you back on in a bit to talk about your MIT graduate application and that process, because actually most of my clients are more, you know, they're engineering people mm-hmm. who are applying for grad school. So as we were talking, I mean, it's great to talk about the undergrad, Ivy League, Harvard thing. And there's yeah. a lot of people who care about that. I just realized that you have so much information and so many great experiences about admissions and about these processes that we could have another hour of just graduate school yeah. application talk.
Totally.
And so you were so kind as to offer 5 20-minute consultations for free for listeners to this podcast.
Yeah.
Would you know what that URL would be? I don't believe you have it up yet, but
no.
Would you know what that URL would be when you put it up?
No. I'll have to give you the link. You'll find the link in the description.
Okay, so we'll put the link down as part of the description, so you should be able to have access to it right below wherever you're listening to this. And so if you have to act quick, because there's only 5 spots available for this. Mm-hmm. So definitely take advantage of this. So what it'll be is you can sign up for a newsletter, and then also you'll get in touch with her about setting up that consultation.
Yep. Yeah. And if you sign up for my interview, I have a couple of, you know, free gifts for anybody who signs up for the newsletter that includes a workbook for planning your base, which is what we talked, planning your hook, you know, and also a GPA boot camp.
And that's all just your gift for signing up. Wow.
Yep.
So that's all that. Plus, if you can get the $20, even if you can't get the $20 consultation, I recommend that you sign up for her newsletter,
because there's, yeah.
there's a lot of great material, and obviously she's very knowledgeable about this process, and she's been through it herself. She's coached
yeah.
a lot of students through this process, so definitely take advantage of that. Well, Jessica, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak to me.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Sure thing. So thank you. Thanks again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.